Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast.
All right, and we are live. This is going to be the October live stream for Game Master's Journey. So thank you, everyone who's tuning in. Give everybody a minute to get here. Just want to let you know really quickly at the beginning of this that I am taking a couple weeks off of Game Master's Journey, the podcast, before starting season 11. And there's a few reasons for that. One reason is my wife, Nikki, and I both have birthdays this week. So we're hoping to take a little time off for that. The other reason is I am starting a new D&D campaign here next week. And I've been very busy preparing for that and everything involved with that, which I will talk about here more in a minute. So this live stream we're doing now, I'll probably put it in the feed this week or next week, I'm thinking. So this may actually be the first episode for season 11 in the podcast feed. I'm not sure. Ideally, this wouldn't be the first episode of the season, and I would do another episode first. But because I'm taking some time off, it may work out that this is the first episode. So there won't be a Game Master's Journey this week. Next week, there won't be unless I release the live stream, and then we'll be back at it. But next week I will have my D&D game, which I'll talk about. Thank you, Josh, in the chat. Wish me happy birthday. I'm going to be the big 4-1 this year, I think. It's funny how you get to that point in your life where suddenly you don't even remember how old you are anymore. I have to do the math with my birthday. Let's see. So welcome everyone in chat. If you have a question or something you'd like me to talk about today, feel free to give me a holler in chat. I got a few things I want to go over myself, but other than that, I didn't really come with a prepared topic today, so hopefully someone else will have something they want to talk about. So I am Lex Starwalker, in case that you're new to me and my channel. I produce a RPG podcast, Game Master's Journey, and this live stream is something I do currently once a month. It was a milestone that we hit on our Patreon for Starwalker Studios. And so once a month, I just do this live stream and just hang out with you guys and talk about RPG stuff. And thank you, David, for the happy birthday. Appreciate it. So let me get to my list here before I get completely derailed. I am starting a new D&D campaign next week, and that will be on here on the YouTube channel. We're going to live stream it. That is going to be Tuesday, October 10th. We are going to start at 5 p.m. Pacific time, and we play until 8 p.m. Pacific time. This is going to be a weekly thing. We're going to do this every Tuesday the same week, and this is going to be an adventure of my own creation in my homebrew D&D setting, Primordia, and it's going to pretty much be original stuff. So those of you that have watched some of my other actual plays on this channel, I've done a lot of published campaigns lately, but actually the lion's share of my experience as a GM is actually with my own stuff. In fact, it wasn't until I take it back. 3.5 was the first time I actually ran anything published, but it wasn't really until Pathfinder and later Numenera and then D&D 5th edition that I ran very much published stuff at all. So it's going to be good to get back to my roots and run my own thing. And hopefully it will be better for people watching because everybody can watch it. Because the problem with running one of these published campaigns, like let's say I started doing Tomb of Annihilation right now, is if you're going to be playing Tomb of Annihilation, you probably wouldn't want to watch that. So I don't know how many possible viewers I've lost because they were afraid of spoilers. But with this campaign, that won't be an issue. So right now I have six players and a seventh on deck who will hopefully join us later in October or maybe early November. But right now we have six players. We're starting at level two, and it's going to pull in some kind of West Marches elements. There's going to be an exploration aspect to the campaign. And the past couple weeks, I've been doing little preludes with each of the players. So instead of having like a quote session zero, like some groups would do, we handled a lot of that kind of stuff via a forum that we have for the campaign. But I did get together with each player individually to discuss their character, kind of help them flesh out their backstory, make sure they kind of had a feel for how their character fits in the world and how they're getting into the story of the adventure. So I'm actually doing the last of those after this live stream tonight with Emmanuel, and then they'll all be done. And I did record those, and I am going to edit those and release those on the channel as well, because I thought, assuming that people watch this campaign and get into it, that it'd be nice to be able to get some of the background information on the player characters that, you know, may not come out in the narrative of the main campaign for a while, and to see some of the discussion that we had as far as character creation and character concepts and all that stuff. And a big part of why I'm doing this, why I'm streaming this campaign and putting it on YouTube, is I am hoping to use it to help newer GMs who are looking for guidance on how to run games, how to prepare for games, how to create your own adventures, all that kind of stuff. I get questions from listeners of the podcast all the time about that kind of thing. And up till this point in Game Master's Journey, that's been a lot of what we've talked about on the podcast, but it's all very theoretical, you know, and I personally believe that the best way to learn anything is through your own personal experience, learn by doing. And the next best way to learn, other than doing it yourself, is to watch someone else do it and be able to get their thoughts as far as why they're doing what they're doing, be able to ask them questions and get feedback. And so I think for those GMs out there who are looking for guidance, this will be a far better way to provide that than just me on a podcast talking about my philosophies as a GM, to actually see me run a game and be able to talk with me about what I'm doing and why I'm doing what I'm doing. So in addition to the actual play videos and the preludes, I am also going to produce videos that are discussions of the campaign and the game itself, where kind of behind the DM screen, where I will talk about how I prepared for various sessions, how I created various adventures. What I ideally would love to do is do a kind of pregame before every session and talk about, okay, here's what I'm planning for tonight, here's how I think it's going to go, and then do a post game after the session and say, hey, well, this is what actually happened, and here's things that went differently than what I thought and how I reacted to them and things like that. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to do that every time, just because I have to go to my day job, or I guess my night job, right after the campaign. So I don't have time after the game sessions to do that. I might try to do it the next day, though. And I also don't have time before the sessions. So I'm going to be producing those videos, those kind of behind the screen kind of DM commentary videos, just as I have time to do it. And also, they're going to have to be time shifted, which is to say, I'm going to have to kind of sit on those videos and wait to release them to you until we're far enough ahead in the campaign that I'm not going to spoil you if you're watching the campaign, and I'm also not going to spoil the players if they watch those videos. So it's going to be a lot of, just like creating a campaign, it's going to be a lot of front-loaded work at the beginning where I'm producing these videos but not releasing them right away. And then eventually we'll get caught up, and hopefully every week you'll get an actual play video, and you'll get at least one commentary video where I'm talking about things that happened in the actual play. So what I really encourage you to do and ask you to do is, if you watch the actual play, if at any point during the session you have a question or a comment as far as, oh, I wonder why Lex did that, or I wonder what's going on here, please ask those questions or give those comments in the comments for the YouTube video on YouTube. Because my plan is when I discuss a given game session, I'm going to go to those comments to look for what you want to hear about, what questions you have, and be sure to address those. And I've been pretty lucky thus far. My YouTube comments have not been the cesspool that many are. Hopefully that won't change. So I think that will work. If I don't know if my channel blows up and there are way too many YouTube comments to deal with, I may have to come up with a better way to do that in the future. But for now, I think that will work. So that's what I'm planning. That's what I've been working on. So in a way, it's like I'm taking 2 weeks off of the podcast, but I'm spending that time working on this other stuff, which will eventually be part of the podcast. I don't think I'm going to put the actual play in the Game Master's Journey podcast, but I think I may put the audio from the discussion videos in the podcast, maybe. So let me know what you think about that, if you think that should be part of the podcast or not. I'm still kind of debating whether those should be or not. And I may not know until I actually make some of them and see, you know, would this work well as part of the podcast or not? So let's see. Thank you, DM Nell. DM Nell wished me happy birthday as well. Okay. And David Long has a suggestion for something to talk about. Awesome, David. I will get to that after I get through my little list here, which we're actually already almost all the way through. Or actually we are. I've already said everything on my list. So yeah, couple weeks on the next podcast episode, but the new campaign starts next Tuesday, and we're going to live stream to YouTube. But if you can't be here for the live stream, those videos will be available on YouTube later. So you don't have to watch them live if you don't want to, or if you can't. So yeah, really excited about the campaign, and really excited to talk about it in these videos I want to make. And it's this is good, at least from my perspective, for a few reasons. One reason is I've been wanting to do more with my YouTube channel, and I feel like for whatever reason, there seems to be more of an audience on YouTube, or it seems like you can have more of a reach more people on YouTube than with a podcast. And I haven't really produced a show that's not actual play for YouTube where I've been able to leverage the ability to have video and be able to show you things. So I think it'll be a great medium to discuss the kinds of things we talk about on Game Master's Journey. And also, kind of like I said earlier, I feel like a lot of our discussion on Game Master's Journey, 181 episodes now, it's been very theoretical. And I want to get more into, you know, giving you examples, you know, so being able to watch a game and then see what's being done and then get kind of behind the scenes discussion on why is the DM doing what he's doing? How is he doing it? You know, that kind of thing. And I think that will be a lot more helpful to new GMs than just, you know, these theoretical discussions. The other thing is, after 181 episodes of Game Master's Journey, plus 70 some episodes of GM Intrusions before that, this is like, I always forget, it's like 2, 3, or 4 years I've been doing these shows. I kind of feel like I've talked about most of the major things, at least that I can think of to talk about as far as things I could talk about to help new GMs. So I was approaching this point with Game Master's Journey that I was starting to think, you know, I feel like it's either time to retire the show, which I don't want to do, or it's time to change gears and start doing something different. Because I've started to notice that I've started on some recent episodes, I've actually talked about things that I talked about 2 years ago, 100 episodes ago or something. So hopefully I said new and different things in the more recent version, but I don't want to just start repeating myself. So yeah, this is going to be good. This is going to give us new content for Game Master's Journey and also allow me to shift some of the more kind of instructional material into these YouTube productions, which again might be part of the podcast. We'll see. And that will free me up to do different things with Game Master's Journey. And I'm still thinking about what kind of different things I'd like to do with Game Master's Journey. One idea is I'd love to do more interviews with other GMs. And so that's something I could do more of instead of this more instructional stuff. I definitely want to continue my series on the Dungeon Master's Guide. And, you know, it's really surprised me how popular the episodes I did on the Player's Handbook and the episodes on the Dungeon Master's Guide have been. I actually started doing those because of a listener suggestion who talked about on forums, they have these let's read threads where someone reads through a book and discusses it like page by page. And I'd never heard of this kind of thing. And I was a little dubious about doing something like that on the show because I honestly didn't think people would want to listen to it. I honestly thought that listening to someone get nitty gritty with the rules would be boring and people wouldn't want to listen to it. But this listener suggested it, so I wanted to try it and I thought it could be fun. So I started with the Player's Handbook and just kind of did a quick, dirty job of the Player's Handbook, just focusing more on DM stuff and not so much on player stuff, and was just blown away with how popular those episodes were. So then I decided, well, let's do the Dungeon Master's Guide. And yeah, so that's something people seem to be into. So I'm going to keep doing those episodes, and there's just tons of stuff to talk about there. And I've also, because so many people found value in the Player's Handbook episodes because I was talking about rules that they either never knew existed or forgot about or remembered wrong or whatever. So I've heard from a lot of GMs and even players who said it was really useful to kind of learn the game or as a refresher. So I've also considered going through the Sage Advice compendium. So Jeremy Crawford, the rules lead for D&D, makes this Sage Advice compendium, which is a bunch of not so much errata as clarifications of the rules, questions that people commonly have about the rules and going into the nitty gritty of how the rules work above and beyond what's in the books. So I've once or twice on our community on Google Plus, I've asked people if they'd be interested in that, and people said they were. So at some point I'm going to start going through those. And as part of that, I think I will also do at least some episodes on some of the Sage Advice segments of the D&D podcast, Dragon Talk, which is kind of weird. Seems kind of meta. It's like, why don't you just go listen to Jeremy Crawford on Dragon Talk? But not everybody can do that or wants to do that. And as long as I have something to say about it, other than just reiterating what Jeremy said, then that could be fun too. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking right now for Game Master Journey going forward is going to try to do more interviews. We're going to keep doing the DMG episodes, probably do some Sage Advice kind of stuff. And then I don't know what else. Come up with something. So if you have any ideas, let me know. Shoot me an email, gamemasterjourney@gmail.com. If you have any ideas of just new things I could do with the podcast that you'd like to see. All right, let's see what people are saying in chat. Josh says, I'm really new to D&D, running my first campaign, and I love those videos. Great way for me to learn the right way to implement rules. David says, the DMG review has been great. I need to go back to hear the PHB episodes. So those are in the feed. And actually, if you go to any of the DMG episodes in the show notes, I have links to all of the DMG episodes and all of the PHB episodes. So let me look what the most recent one was. Let's see. My internet's being slow, probably because I'm streaming right now. Let's see here. It looks like the last DMG episode was 179, Creating a Multiverse. So if you go to StarWalkerCEOs.com/GameMastersJourney/179 and look at the show notes there, there will be links to all of the DMG episodes and all of the PHB episodes. And the next DMG episode is going to be about the astral plane. So I'm in chapter 2 now, I think, of the DMG, and we're going to go into the outer planes. Or not just all the planes. So the first one, we're going to talk about the astral plane. And not only am I going to cover what's in the DMG on the astral plane, but I've also got the third edition manual of the planes. And I'm going to go into some of that too, because what we have on the planes in the DMG is fairly limited. And most of what is in there, it actually comes directly word for word from the third edition manual of the planes, or 3.5. So we'll pull stuff from there too, especially for those of you that didn't play 3.5 and haven't seen that, can give you more information about the planes and some more ideas of what you can do with them. All right, let's see. Thank you, Jason, for the happy birthday. Yes, I'm going to have, more guests on the show soon. I actually have, I think, 3 people that I'm hoping to have on Game Master's Journey in the near future, and they're going to be some fantastic interviews with listener GM. So I'm looking forward to doing that. All right. So a minute ago, hang on here. There we go. David Long had something he suggested I could talk about, which is the Trickster's Labyrinth, which is the D&D adventure I published. And how easy it might be to adapt to levels higher than third. So, yeah, I can talk about that a little bit. So, first of all, the adventure was designed to take characters from level 3 to level 5. So, I think if you had characters anywhere in that range, you probably wouldn't have to do much, if anything, to adjust it. I think you would be able to just run it as is, as long as your characters weren't much higher than level 5. Now, if your characters are higher than level 5, you might want to do some adjusting, just because, you know, you want it to be challenging, right? I mean, if the whole thing is easy, it's not going to be very much fun. And it's fine to have some encounters that are easy and aren't really much of a challenge. That can be fine once in a while, just for a change of pace and let the players feel like they're badasses. But if the entire adventure is like that, that'll be pretty boring. So I think with fifth edition, I think it's really easy to scale stuff up, especially. Even scaling down isn't super hard, but it's really easy to scale things up, I think. You can use the various tools that we have to help you. We've got the encounter building guidelines in the Dungeon Master's Guide, and we also have the Unearthed Arcana article on encounter balancing that gives a different system you can use. The one in the DMG uses XP and XP budgets, basically. The one in the Unearthed Arcana uses more just charts. Me personally, I use both. I start with the Unearthed Arcana to kind of decide where I'm going. And then once I've kind of designed the encounter, I plug the numbers into the DMG method just to see what it gives me. Because there is some variance with the Unearthed Arcana. Sometimes it will give you much more challenging encounters than what you would think. And really, I think the biggest part of that comes down to what we call action economy, which is just simply how many actions do the player characters have in a round versus how many actions do their adversaries have in a round. And when those are equal, that's a fairly kind of middle of the road encounter that will probably be somewhat challenging, isn't going to be super easy, isn't going to be, you know, impossible, anything like that. And then if you go below that, if the bad guys have less actions than the players, then it's going to tend to weigh towards the players. If you go the other way, if the bad guys have more actions than the players, then it's going to start getting harder pretty quick. So I recently, let me see if I can find it. I recently did an episode about where I talked about, I think it was one of the live streams. Yeah. So episode 177 of the show, our fifth live stream, I talked about scaling encounters on the fly. So definitely check that out, because I think a lot of what I talked about for scaling encounters on the fly work also for something like this, where you're taking an adventure that was maybe designed for lower level than what your player characters are, or maybe fewer characters, and you want to kind of beef it up a little bit. So I think you can use a lot of the same techniques. So one of the kind of main ideas I had in that, and something that I'm actually planning to do more of in the campaign I'm preparing now, is having more adversaries available to use than what you think you're going to need. So let's take an example of goblins. Okay, so let's say you're planning an encounter with goblins, and let's say you decide, I think six goblins is a good challenge for the player characters. Maybe you have six PCs and you think, I think six goblins will be a good challenge. So when you run the encounter, don't have there be just six goblins, have there be 12 goblins. And the idea is, well, there's 12 goblins, but not all of them are going to engage directly with the PCs. And then that way, if you say, okay, well, there's 12 goblins and six of them are going to be fighting the PCs, the other six are going to be, maybe they're not there, maybe they're just nearby, maybe they're scouting around, maybe they're hanging back or whatever. And then that way, if the encounter is way too easy, you can just bring more goblins in, and, you know, it's, you don't have to explain how you did that. You know, if the player characters know, you know, there's more than six goblins around, we're just fighting six right now, and then the second round, two more show up, you know, you don't really have to explain that. It's already been explained. And you can either, there's kind of two ways you can do that. You can either just keep bringing more adversaries in round by round as you need to. So it's kind of this one big combat that just, you know, more people keep coming in. Or you can do waves, which is where you're actually doing separate encounters, but you're not giving any, you're not giving enough time between the encounters that the player characters can take a short rest. So maybe six goblins attack them, they fight and defeat six goblins, and then they have a minute to catch their breath or whatever, and then six more attack or something like that. So as far as the Trickster's Labyrinth specifically, the easiest thing to do as far as to make it more challenging is just increase the numbers of whatever the monsters or whatever are. So if they're fighting zombies and there are, you know, four zombies, have there be eight zombies instead or whatever. So that's the easiest way where you don't really have to do, you can do that on the fly. You don't have to do any real work or bookkeeping. You're just like, okay, you know, this was for lower level, so I'm going to throw more of these guys in. Another way that you can do it is either swap out the monsters with more powerful monsters or beef up the monsters that are in there. So you might say, well, you know, zombies are kind of weak because my characters are higher level. So instead of zombies, I'm going to use ghouls. So ghouls are similar to zombies in that they're both undead. They're both corporeal, which is to say physical undead. They're not like ghostly, insubstantial undead. So you could kind of swap one for the other and make it work. And that would be the easier way to do it. Or you could take the zombie and make it tougher. Give it more hit points, give it a better attack bonus, give it a higher armor class, things like that. Now, if you're going to do that, you might want to consider referring to the monster building rules in the back of the DMG and figuring out what its new CR is going to be, just to avoid going way too far and making something way too powerful. And that can get a little noodly figuring that out. But yeah, that's a couple things you could do. So just add more, you know, if it's zombies, just make it more zombies. Swap them out with a higher CR monster that's similar and fits thematically, or just use something differently entirely, or just modify the monster so that they're tougher. But a lot of times in encounters, you may have like one monster that's kind of tough, like maybe like a CR 2 or 3 or 4 or something like that, and he's got kind of minions with them that are like CR 1/4 or CR 1/8 or whatever. So a lot of times what I'll do if I need to kind of ramp up an encounter like that is I'll increase the number of the minions. So there's still only one higher CR guy, but he's got more of the little guys with him. Because, you know, again, the action economy really comes into play. So adding more zombies, I mean, you're not really adding that much as far as damage that the player characters have to do or anything like that, because zombies aren't super tough. But you're adding more actions on the other side. That's more attacks coming in at the characters. It's more damage they're going to take, and it makes it more challenging. So I hope that helps. But definitely check out that episode 177, because I went into quite a bit of detail about how I scale encounters on the fly, and so you know you can definitely apply all that to doing prep and kind of scaling it during your prep. Let's see. Dan says, I'm still making my way through your backlog. Thank you so much for your series. During Theater of the Mind episode, you talked about maybe covering tricks for grid play. Is that still on the table? Maybe. In all honesty, probably not in the near future, if only because this campaign I'm getting ready to run is going to be Theater of the Mind. My hope is to not use a grid at all, or at the very least, very seldomly. So I'm not going to be using a grid. Other than Dan, I haven't heard from anybody that was interested in hearing an episode about tricks of using the grid. And honestly, I'm not a huge fan of grid play, and I definitely wouldn't consider myself a master of it. So I don't know if I'd be even the best person to talk about that. The best advice I can give you when it comes to grid play is come to class prepared. I think if you're using grids, that's even more true than it is otherwise. And I think it's always true as a GM, you should always come prepared, but with a grid, even more so. So if you're drawing your grids by hand, have those done ahead of time. If you're drawing it on some kind of wet erase thing, have it done ahead of time. Don't make the players sit there while you draw the thing. Make sure you got all your miniatures and crap ready to go and organized. Because my biggest reason I dislike grid play, whether as a player or a GM, is because there's this massive break between the moment we start combat to the moment we actually start combat, because we got to set up the grid, we got to set up all the minis and blah, 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 blah. And the less prepared the GM is, the less organized the GM is, the longer all that takes. And that's time that the players are just sitting there twiddling their thumbs at what should be this very high intensity, high emotion moment of, oh my God, we're going into combat. And instead you totally shoot yourself in the foot and you lose all of that because, well, now we got to sit here for 10 minutes, bored off our asses while the DM gets ready. So I'd say like what I used to do when I ran using a grid in person is I would have the first combat set up before the game started. I would have all the miniatures up and whatever, and I'd just cover it up or something. So when the combat happened, I just, whoop, I pull off the sheet or whatever, and everything's ready to go, and we jump right into it. You know, I've even started having players roll initiative before we ever get to an encounter, because even just rolling initiative to me kills the momentum and the suspense of going into a combat. And I like to even avoid that. So when you use minis, it makes it even worse. Now, if you're using a virtual tabletop, it's different, but also the same. You still want to be prepared. You want to have all your tokens made. You want to have them on the map already. You want to have everything set up so that from the moment you realize a combat's going to happen to the moment that players are actually doing something, that that's the smallest amount of time as possible. So if you're using something like Roll20, where you have different layers, like for instance, Roll20, there's a GM layer that you can have things on there that the players can't see. So I would already have, like when I ran Hidden Shrine Tomahawken, I already had all the tokens for all the monsters, for all the combats on the map in the GM layer. So when it came to time to do it combat, all I had to do was go into the GM layer, move the tokens to the token layer, and boom, they're there. I didn't have to go find tokens. I didn't have to go copy them from another map or whatever. So as far as miniature play, the best advice I can give you is do everything you can to minimize the amount of time you spend at the table during play screwing with the miniatures in the map to make it as seamless as possible. Let's see. DM Nell says, how about first impressions of Tomb of Annihilation? So I just got that a few days ago and I've started flipping through it. And let me try. I wish I had the book in front of me. Let's see. There are definitely some things about it I like. what's usually the case with these campaigns that Wizards put out is I look more for things that I can use in other ways, because, I mean, who has time to run all these campaigns, right? And I'm planning to run a homebrew campaign. I'm not going to run Tomb of Annihilation, but I still like reading these adventures because sometimes they'll do interesting things that I haven't seen before or give me ideas. You can get ideas for adventure locations and NPCs and different encounters you can use and things like that. So one thing I digged about it was I liked their random encounter table. So they have one huge table. They're finally back to using percentile dice for encounter tables, which makes me happy. and they have different columns on one table for different encounter areas, basically. So you roll on one table and the column you look at is depending on where you are. So there's one table for the whole thing. And I would love to build something like that for my campaign I'm doing, where I have these different areas with different encounter tables. I was like, well, how cool is that if I could put them all on one massive table? But for me to do that as an individual DM, that's a lot of work. It's worth it to do it for a published thing that lots of people are going to use, but just for me to use it myself, it's probably not worth the effort to put all my encounters on one table. But I thought that was really cool. They have some cool ideas, like they have a cache table. So the idea is, in the jungles of Chalt, there's been numerous exploration expeditions, and people will hide away caches of supplies and even magic items or potions or whatever. And, you know, they get themselves killed or whatever, and they never come back to get their gear. So, you know, an encounter you can have is finding one of these hidden supply caches, and it may have rations. It may have a healer's kit. It could have potions. It could have, I mean, really anything, money, you know? So I thought that was cool, and that's something I'm going to try to use a little bit in my campaign. Doesn't work super well for Primordia because there haven't been a lot of explorers in the last 5 years, but there could be caches from before that player characters could find. I really liked that, and I've just started reading it. I'm trying to think, because I know there were some other things about it that I thought were pretty cool. I guess I'd have to go run and get my book to remember. The port city where the player characters start, I forget what it's called. That's basically the part I've completely read is all about that city. And I like the city, and they had some cool ideas as far as some of the things that are in the city. And it's a city run by these merchant princes. And I like some of the stuff of how the law and politics of the city work, and kind of a different government structure than just having, you know, the feudal like baron or lord or king or whatever. So that was pretty cool. And I'm just totally blanking, because I know there are some things that I really liked about it. I can't think of them, but I'm probably going to do, or maybe going to do, some kind of review of that at some point, hopefully, once I finish reading it. Like I said, I'm not going to run it. And I think it's hard to do a review of an adventure when you don't run it. But yeah. Yeah, it seems pretty, like the book seems pretty thick. I don't know how it compares as far as page count with the other ones, but it seems like there's a lot in there. Let's see. Yeah, so DM now says he's a grid user and he agrees about having everything ready ahead of time. And that it can take a lot of time, especially if you have to have the right miniature for everything. So I think, you know, I know a lot of times in the RPG community, we like to debate, you know, like this whole theater of the mind or grid play. Like you have to do one or the other. And we like to debate, you know, I think this is better. I think that is better. And I think personally, I think a big part of it is just how much you like the miniature side of things. I mean, there are people who just like miniatures. They like collecting miniatures. They like painting miniatures. And all that. And the more you like that kind of stuff, the more you're going to like grid and mini play. Like me personally, I don't care about miniatures. I've never owned more than a few handfuls of miniatures. I would never want to paint them, and because I would be terrible at it. And you know, if I could go into a store and be like, I want this, 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 and this miniature, that might be cool. But the way that they're like, it's like buying magic cards. You don't know what you're going to get as far as the plastic ones that are quote painted. I'm not a fan of that. It's like, I don't want to like play the game of collecting miniatures. So, you know, that's probably at least part of the reason that I don't like using a grid is that has no appeal to me. So it's purely a question of what's going to give me the gameplay experience I want, what's going to take less time at the table, what's going to be less of a hassle. But, you know, if you're someone that loves collecting miniatures, well, obviously, if I had hundreds of miniatures that I collected and hand-painted, I'd want to use them. So I think sometimes that has as much to do with it as if there is one way that's, quote, better than the other, which I don't think there is. I think the way that you're used to and that you're most comfortable with is probably the best way for you. So, and if I need to use them, I will, you know, which is why I say, I hope to not use them in my campaign, but I mean, I haven't planned every encounter for the whole campaign, so I don't know what all we're going to do. And there may come a point where I decide I'm going to use a grid for this because I think it will be easier. And I think it's worth the time it's going to take to set it up and everything else. I don't know. I feel like online, if you're running like with a virtual tabletop, there's a lot more extra time it takes to use the grid than there is in person. You know, even if you're like drawing it out, it doesn't really take that long unless you're adding a lot of details. Because I used to, when I ran Pathfinder, I had the wet erase grid things that you'd use a marker and draw the thing on. And I would just draw the one for the first encounter before the game session. And then the, you know, after we did the first encounter, we take a break. And while we were on break, I'd draw the one for the next encounter that we were probably going to do. And it didn't take that much time, but when you're dealing with something like Roll20 and you got to find tokens and you got to, import the images and crop them and format them. And then you got to assign the attributes to them and put them on the grid and blah, blah, blah. Like it, I would spend hours setting up Roll20 for a campaign, just designing tokens and all that crap. So I feel like online it adds a lot more time than it does in person. But I don't know. When I use the grid in person, like we had miniatures for the heroes and that was it. All the monsters and stuff were like chess pieces or checkers or coins or M&Ms or things like that. So I didn't have to worry about, oh, I got to find five goblin miniatures. I just grab five pawns from the chess set or whatever. So maybe like DM Nell says, maybe if you've got a million miniatures and you need the right miniature for each thing, that could take longer. But again, I feel like if you prepare ahead of time, then you won't have that problem. But of course, that's assuming that you know what the encounters are going to be ahead of time. And the more sandboxy you're, what you're doing, the less that's probably true. And then you might have situations where an encounter comes up that you didn't know was going to happen. And now you got to find the right miniatures for that or draw the map for it or whatever. So, yeah. So DM now asks, Lex, how do you like to hook into Temple of Annihilation or Tomb of Annihilation, whichever it is? I don't see why first level adventurers would care if resurrection magic is failing. Seems to be a problem for the rich who can afford such magic. Yeah, I totally agree. Pretty much every adventure Wizards has put out for 5th edition, I've been unimpressed with their hooks. I think that's really a weak point with these adventures. They don't seem to give much thought or spend much time coming up with good hooks. And I kind of wonder, because I don't think for a minute that they can't do it. I imagine it's probably a thing of time management. And I just wonder if maybe it's a thing of, well, really every GM is going to have to come up with their own hook for their own players that fit their characters. So as far as these kind of generic hooks we give you, we're going to kind of phone it in because you're not going to use them anyway. Like maybe that's what they're thinking. I don't know. But I do feel like they could do a much better job of coming up with hooks that would actually work, because like DM Nell says, like basically the hook is an NPC. I think, again, I don't have the book in front of me, but I think there's an NPC that like basically hires the player characters to investigate this thing. And it's like, yeah, why would they care? A first level character hasn't been resurrected, probably doesn't know anyone who's been resurrected, probably isn't planning on being resurrected themselves anytime soon. So like, why would they care? It would seem like it'd have nothing to do with them. And it seemed like, you know, this is the problem with like Forgotten Realms, right? Like you'd think this would be something Elminster would be dealing with, or Dritzed, or some high level NPC who either has been resurrected or does have friends who've been resurrected. You know, you'd think one of these higher level groups of player characters would be the ones investigating this, not a bunch of first level characters that this has nothing to do with. So that's definitely, I definitely agree, DM. Now, I think it's a pretty terrible hook. And as a DM, you're going to have to do better than that, because it's kind of lame. And I think you kind of owe it to your players to give them a decent hook. You know, to give them a start in why is my character doing this? What is my character motivation? And you know, this is hopefully something we're going to talk about in the near future on Game Master's Journey in one of the interviews is about character arcs and looking at RPGs from the point of view of character motivation and how, like I think Brett and I talked about this a little bit, about how I think a big part of this idea of railroading and GMs railroading players is that the GMs aren't properly leveraging character motivation. You know, if I want you to go explore this dungeon and I'm just like, go explore this dungeon because that's the adventure we're doing tonight and I'm not going to let you do anything else, then yeah, that feels like railroading. But if I want you to go explore the dungeon and I say, hey, John, remember in your detailed backstory that you came up with, how you have this twin sister that you do anything for? Well, guess what? She got kidnapped and someone hauled her off to this dungeon. What do you want to do? And John's going to be like, I want to go rescue my sister, right? And that won't feel railroaded to John, even though it's just as much me saying this is where I want the player to go as the other example, but it's all in how I'm doing it. And because I'm using a character motivation that John came up with for his character, it's going to seem like something he's choosing to do, and it's going to make sense, right? You're not going to have that moment where John's like in the middle of a combat, John's like, why are we here? Why are we doing this? Why are we risking death in this dungeon? Why don't we just go home? Right? Because he knows why he's there. And it's something that's important to his character. So I think that's really important. And I think as a GM at the beginning of the campaign, the least we can do for our players is kind of help them out a little bit with why your character is doing this, you know, why this is important to you. And hopefully you'll see this a little bit when you can watch the preludes that I did for my campaign, how I kind of did that with every player. Part of what we did in the prelude was me kind of figuring out why is your character doing what you're doing? What's your motive for this? I mean, I already had a motive. Like, I'm like, I want you to go on this mission for the guild, right? But I wanted it to make sense that character would do that. So part of what we were doing in the prelude, if we hadn't already done it through email, was figuring out why this character is someone that would want to do that. Apex Warlord says, any comment on the Guild Adept program on the DM's Guild? No, I have no comment on that. I'm only vaguely aware of what that is, to be honest. I've seen Wizards tweeting about it, and I frankly went and looked at it, saw that it had nothing to do with me, and that was about the extent of my looking into it. I am fortunate in that I have a website that I can sell things on my website, and I have my wife is a web designer, so if there's anything I don't know how to do on the website, she knows how to do it. And I'm also fortunate that I am not afraid to self-publish. So every once in a while I have people ask me why isn't the Trickster's Labyrinth on the DM's Guild, or why isn't it on what's it called, Drive-Thru RPG? And the answer is simply because I have my own website. I don't need them, right? Like I have my own website. I know how to publish on my own website. I don't need someone else to do that for me. And I don't need someone else to take a huge chunk of my profits for doing that for me. DM's Guild, they take 50% of whatever you make. And that's insane. Now, if you're someone that like, you have no recourse and you just want to throw something out there for people to use, and you don't so much care about return on investment, or you don't so much care about profit margins, or you just don't have the time or knowledge or desire to do it yourself, then I'm sure DM's Guild can be great. It's certainly great for Wizards. But you know, if those things aren't true, then it's not so great. So for someone like me, I have my own website where I can sell stuff, and I know how to do it. And yeah, I went OGL because I want control. The other thing about the DM's Guild is anything you put on the DM's Guild, anybody else can use. So if I put Trickster's Labyrinth on the DM's Guild, people can take my monsters that I designed, my magic items that I designed, and use them in their own stuff that they publish on DM's Guild. Now, the gentlemanly thing to do would be to give me credit when they use my magic item in their adventure and say, oh, this came from Lex's The Trickster's Labyrinth. Go check it out. But, you know, they're not obligated to do that. Like, Wizards isn't going to take down their product if they don't do that. And as a creator, as a writer, copyright is very important to me. Keeping control of my intellectual property is very important to me. So even if it weren't for the profit margin thing, just the idea that I can put this thing on DM's Guild and now it's no longer mine exclusively, and other people can steal from it and they don't have to credit me or anything, to me, that's, there's no way in hell I would ever do that. So yeah, you know, I'm not poo-pooing DM's Guild or RPG, Drive-Thru RPG, whatever it's called. It's great for people that need that, you know, and it's like, you know, they are doing stuff for you. So it's okay that they make their cut. I'm not, you know, saying that what they're doing is wrong or anything like that. But for me personally, I don't want anything to do with it. The only possible benefit to publishing on DMs Guild or DriveThruRPG would be exposure, would be, well, maybe someone sees my thing because they're shopping around on DriveThruRPG or DMs Guild and they would have never known about it otherwise. And I might get a sale from someone like that. But it's like, well, when you consider that they're taking 50% of what I make, I would have to double the number of units I'm selling to just break even to what I'm doing on my website. And I don't think that my exposure on either of those places would double the number of copies I sell. So it's just, it's not even in the realm of considering whether it's worth it or not. And frankly, I mean, I have my podcast, I have my YouTube channel. So I have my own ways to get the word out to people who might be interested. And also I think it's far more likely that someone who listens to my podcast or watches my YouTube channel would actually buy an adventure written by me than just some person on DriveThruRPG or DMs Guild who doesn't know who I am. If they don't know who I am, why would they buy my thing? And if they know who I am, then I don't need DMs Guild or RPG Now for them to find out who I am. So yeah. So for all of you who've asked about that, there's a more in-depth answer to that question, because usually I give a pretty short answer. So yeah, sorry, Apex Warrior or Warlord, I don't really have anything to say about the Guild of Debt program. I don't really know much about it. DM Now says he loves his minis. And see, that makes sense to me. That's fitting my hypothesis that, you know, DM Now loves minis and he loves the grid. I think that correlation is not unusual. You know, if I were more artistically skilled and I were someone who could paint good minis, and I probably would, I would totally get into that. I just don't have the skills or the patience to learn or be able to do that well. But if I did, then I probably would collect minis. And then if I collected minis, I definitely would want to use them in my games. And I probably wouldn't want to play online because I'm like, I want to play in person and use my cool minis. So, yeah. Let's see. David says he uses a mix of grid and theater of the mind. Yeah. And DM Nell says he has over 3,000 minis. Yeah. So, yeah. For DM Nell not to use his minis would be insane. Like, obviously. And you know, when... See, that's another part of it, too, is, you know, if you have 3,000 minis and they're all painted and they're all nice and you have like the exact mini that you need for the encounter or the exact minis, you know, I'm sure that adds a lot more to the experience than if you're using chess pieces like what I used to do. Right. So again, you know, you and your players are going to be more favorable toward the mini thing, even if you have to wait 10 minutes to set everything up. Because it's really adding a lot that, you know, M&Ms don't, because you can actually see this huge red dragon mini that you have or whatever. And, you know, I mean, to kind of turn this around another way, if someone sent me 3,000 minis, I would probably use them. And I would be one of those guys that are like, I always use minis. I always use a grid. I wouldn't play D&D without it. So yeah. I think it really, like I said, I think it really comes down to what you're comfortable with as a DM. I think what's best for you is whatever's best for you, you know, and you probably know what that is, unless you just haven't tried doing it a different way. All right. So I've been rambling for about an hour now. I should probably wrap this up. I think I talked about everything I wanted to talk about. So I apologize if I did not do a good job answering your question. But as far as Tomb of Annihilation, I will probably discuss that at greater length, either on the podcast or on here when I can have the book in front of me and when I can read more of it. Because I went through the monsters. Oh, and there's also a few cool new monsters in there that I actually added to my encounter tables I'm making for my campaign in Primordia. So that was another thing I liked about it, is some cool new monsters. I believe there's some cool new magic items, including one or two artifacts, which is always awesome. So I've read those and I've read like the random encounter tables and stuff. And it has like Storm King's Thunder did, it has a chapter where you're just exploring Chult, and it just has all these different locations and things that happen there. And I really like that. And those are especially useful because it's really easy to take that stuff and use it in your own campaign, even if it's in a different setting or whatever. So there's one specific one already that I saw in that chapter that I may actually use in my campaign that I'm running, because I thought it had some cool NPCs. It had a cool idea behind it. And I'm like, well, if I'm using all that, I might as well use the map and everything else too. So, this part of my planning of this campaign was I went through all the published stuff I have from Wizards. So I've got Horde of the Dragon Queen, Rise of Tiamat, I've got Curse of Strahd, I've got Storm King's Thunder, now I've got Tomb of Annihilation, Lost Mines of Phandelver. So I went through those again, looking for any NPCs I might want to use or use for inspiration, any cool encounters or maps I might want to use. So I'm someone who gets these adventures, even if I'm not planning on running them, just because I enjoy reading them. I enjoy seeing how someone else, designs adventures and encounters. And a lot of times I find things that I can use that I can just kind of pick out of there, or at least something I can use as inspiration. Cause I don't necessarily want to take something directly out of Tomb of Annihilation, because my players might've seen an actual play or something and they'd know what that is, but I could take it and kind of use that as my launching point and kind of do my own thing with it. So it's got some cool artwork in there, and I haven't looked at the map yet. I need to tear the map out. I'm kind of afraid to tear the map out, but, yeah. So thank you everyone for tuning in, and thank you to everyone who asked, questions and submitting comments. And hello to Brett, just joined us and says he's curious to read Tomb of Annihilation but very eager to get his hands on Xanathar's Guide. And that's me too. Yeah, I cannot wait. What is that, November? I think that's coming out. I can't wait to see that. And that'll be cool and interesting, because quite a few of the players in our campaign are using Unearthed Arcana stuff that I either know or assume will be updated in Xanathar's Guide. So we've got a bard doing College of Glamour, which I know for sure is going to be in Xanathar's Guide. We've got a bard doing College of Swords, which hopefully will be in Xanathar's Guide. We've got a wizard doing Lore Master, which hopefully will be in there. Trying to think what other Unearthed Arcana stuff people are using. But yeah, it'll be fun to see, you know, how they finished those and made the final version. And hopefully they don't nerf them too bad, so the players aren't too unhappy if their their class gets nerfed. But everybody knows, you know, that it's beta and everybody's prepared. And I know I talked with the lady that is playing the wizard, the lore master, and I said to her that I'm pretty sure it will get nerfed, because it seems like the consensus is that it's probably overpowered. And she was aware of that, and she's prepared for that. But I also said, you know, I'm going to look at it too. And it may be a thing where I'm like, oh, I like what they did with the lore master, this is what we're doing. Or it could be a thing where some of the changes they make, I don't like. And I say, hey, we stick with the Unearthed Arcana one. Or I say, hey, we're going to do something in between. I don't know. We'll see. But yeah, I'm also using a lot of homebrewed stuff in this campaign. So I do have a concern, and this could be something we talk about later, is have I bit off too much as far as things that are being play tested, whether it's Unearthed Arcana or something I made up myself? Is there too much in this campaign that is uncertain that we're play testing? I think that will come down to how well it works. If most of the stuff for playtesting works and we don't have to make a lot of changes to most of it, it'll probably be fine. But if a lot of the stuff we're using is broken and I'm having to fix things, I could end up thinking that I did too much. I bit off more than I could chew, maybe, but we'll see. So Josh asks, what kind of stuff are going in Xanathar's Guide? There are going to be lots of new subclasses. There are going to be new feats, new spells. I don't know what else. Like Brett says, everything. A lot of the subclasses that we've seen in Unearthed Arcana over the last year, they did all those Unearthed Arcanas on all the classes and came up with all these new subclasses. A lot of those we're going to see something like 21 or 24 new subclasses. I think everybody is getting 3 except for the wizard is getting 2 or something like that. I don't know. 24 plus subclasses, new spells, new feats. Yeah. Yeah. So lots of stuff and backgrounds, hopefully. I think you can never have too many backgrounds. So yeah. So I'm going to wrap this up. I have a prelude to do here in a few minutes. So thank you for tuning in. Again, it's going to be a couple weeks before the next Game Master's Journey, but next Tuesday, October 10th, we will be starting our new campaign. So I really hope that you will join us. And again, if you're watching that and you have any questions or comments, put them in the YouTube comments for the video, and then I'll go through those when I do my commentary. So it's kind of like the commentary. I'm kind of thinking like when you watch like a TV show or a movie and they have all the bonus material and they'll have like discussions with the director about, you know, why they did what they did or behind the scenes kind of stuff. It'll be like that. Or even like when they do commentary where they watch the episode and they talk about what's going on. I'm not going to sit there and watch the whole actual play and talk about it. But that's kind of what I'm thinking. Like, so if you have any kind of behind the scenes questions or comments about what's going on in the campaign, definitely let me know. And that's the kind of stuff I'm going to pull from when I start making those videos. I've started editing the preludes. I've edited 2 of them. We're going to end up having 7 because Brett got 2 preludes, sort of. Because Brett and I were together talking about other stuff and his prelude kind of got split up. So once I get all those edited, I'm going to figure out, I'm going to figure out if I'm going to put them all together or not, but I don't think I will. Cause each prelude is about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour. So that would be a crazy long video. So I'll probably do each one separately. I would love to get the preludes out before we start next Tuesday, but that's probably not going to happen just because I am sort of on vacation, a working vacation. So I don't think I will have time to get them all done by next Tuesday. So I don't know when the preludes will be coming out, but hopefully within the next couple weeks. No, Brett, it wasn't because you were rambling. It's just because, I did Brett's prelude first and I don't know. I think we did the whole thing, but I thought like we hadn't covered everything. So we got together again and then I was like, oh, we already talked about all of this, but yeah. So I don't know. I haven't edited the second one. So there might not even be anything in there relevant. I don't know. But yeah. All right. So thanks again, everyone, for coming. And I hope I see all of you, next Tuesday for the campaign. Really excited to get that started. And, have a great month of October. I love October. It's my favorite time of year. Enjoy autumn, everyone. Thanks for watching.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.